Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the program today, taxes and the Second Amendment, greenbacks and the Egyptian economy, and hey, gluten-free diets for all my friends. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 11th of April. I'm Kyle Rizdahl. Good to have you with us. And here's something that happened in the Senate of the United States today. 68 members of the world's greatest deliberative body voted aye on the question of whether it's okay to talk about gun control. The law on which debate will soon begin includes, among other things, an expansion of background checks for gun buyers. Progress, as you know, on anything in Washington lately has been incremental at best. On gun control in particular, states and cities are moving faster. And one thing they're considering is taxing guns and ammunition. Marketplace's David Gura has that story.
Since April 1st, Cook County, Illinois, home to Chicago, has had what it calls a violence tax.
It's a $25 tax per firearm that we sell.
Fred Lucher owns Freddy Bear Sports in Tinley Park, Illinois. Revenues go to the Cook County Health and Hospital System. Last year, it treated more than 800 victims of gun violence at an average cost per patient of $52,000. Lucher says he's concerned about the level of gun violence in Chicago, but he points out Tinley Park is in the suburbs, a half hour from downtown.
They got to curb it, but this isn't the way to do it.
Politicians in many cities and states think it is. Nancy Stout is a tax expert at the University of Southern California. She says this isn't unlike other taxes on tobacco or alcohol.
Individuals who want to own guns, that's fine. The Second Amendment allows you to own guns, but there are certain costs to society of owning that gun, and you'll need to help pay for those.
The California State Assembly is considering a 5-cent tax on each and every bullet to pay for an early childhood mental health program. Next door, Nevada is considering its own tax on both ammunition and firearms to pay for mental health services and to help crime victims. Assemblyman William Horn sponsored the bill.
It sends a message to Washington that this is important to us.
Congresswoman Linda Sanchez has taken notice. She's a Democrat from California, and she wants a 10% tax on all concealable firearms purchases.
To use for anti-violence campaigns, gun safety campaigns, and firearm buyback programs.
Sanchez says a tax is the only way to fund those programs. As of today, however, she's failed to find a single Republican to co-sponsor her bill. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
I think it's fair to say a lot of Democrats aren't quite sure how they feel about the budget that the president released yesterday, especially the bits where he wants to cut the growing costs of Medicare and Social Security. Once you get through the politicking and the posturing, though, there is a pretty fundamental debate to be had here about means testing and higher premiums for the wealthy and who the social safety net should protect anyway. Everybody or just those in need? From the Marketplace Wealth and Poverty Desk, Chrissy Clark reports.
Karen Campbell is 68 years old and lives in Avon, Ohio. She voted for Obama, but she does not like the reductions he's proposing in her Social Security benefits.
It wouldn't affect right now the quality of my life, but I sure know a lot of people that it would.
Campbell and her husband received $2,000 to $3,000 a month in Social Security. Under the president's proposal, which would kick in 2015, the average person would get about $40 less in the first year. But it's not so much the amount that bothers Campbell.
I don't think it's fair to take things away from people when they counted on it, to take it and say, no, sorry, we changed the rules here.
John Ray from Minneapolis is also 68. He gets about $1,600 a month in Social Security, but like the Campbells, he mostly relies on retirement savings. And he says even if he got no Social Security, he'd be fine with that.
Social Security was put in place to help those who were in need. And there are some of us that aren't in need.
But what's traditionally made Social Security so popular is that it benefited everyone, not just those in need. Peter Beresford is a professor of social policy at Brunel University in London. He warns that if benefits start to shrink for those who don't really need them,
the number of people who are better off, but who nonetheless can benefit from it, who might then have the strength and skill and ability to protect it, diminishes.
And Social Security could become more vulnerable and more stigmatized. Of course, it could also become less expensive. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Speaking of government being less expensive, the argument that Washington has to spend less and cut the deficit has become the starting point for any discussion of the federal budget, Democratic, Republican, or otherwise. But where did that notion of austerity come from? Marketplace's Scott Tong has that story.
Economic historian Jason Taylor at Central Michigan University says a big moment for the adherence of austerity, of budget discipline, was post-World War II America.
In 1946, we had a huge decrease in government spending. We went from running huge deficits to running large surpluses, and the unemployment rate was 3.9%.
Washington got out of the way, and the economy thrived. Now, the war period itself made the counterpoint that government spending stoked GDP, but Taylor reminds us politicians like to cherry pick. He says austerity's appeal is that it's simple. Discipline is good. It makes for nice metaphors. An economy is a family. Even if it may not be that simple, argues Brown University's Mark Blythe. He's written a new history of austerity.
When the family spends too much, then they have to cut spending, so it's simple. Well, it's absolutely not like that at all. They don't get to import members of other families into the family in order to tax them for the next generation. We get to do that. It's called immigration.
Blythe says recent decades of prosperity further fueled the flame of markets are the answer, not government spending. Then came the financial crash, and many governments slashed their budgets on advice of the International Monetary Fund. But top IMF economists now say, whoa, austerity made things worse. Economist Justin Wolfers teaches at the University of Michigan.
Those states who did the most stimulus, their economies recovered the most. And those who cut back the most, their economies subsequently underperformed the most.
Wolfers thinks the consensus of economists has moved toward government spending in a weak recovery, while politicians in general have gone the other way. That's his history. The budget cutters, well, they have theirs. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
So I'll tell you what, from now on, I'm only going to say something in this space when the markets go down. All right? All right. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It wasn't all that long ago that a gluten-free diet was what you ate if you had actual allergies. People with celiac disease, for whom a bit of gluten can spell all sorts of unpleasant problems that I'm just not going to get into here. But gluten-free has become the new thing, food sensitivities or not. So, of course, restaurants are jumping on board as fast as they can. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has that story for us.
Fresh Brothers Pizza in Southern California has been serving gluten-free pizza since 2008, when Adam Goldberg started the business with his wife, Debbie.
It's funny, when we first started offering the gluten-free menu, people were like, well, what's gluten?
And for those of you wondering the same thing, gluten is a protein found in wheat and other grains. So eating gluten-free means no flour, no regular crust. An idea, Adam says, that strikes some pizza fans as a little off.
They just can't comprehend the concept of a pizza not having flour in it.
But flourless pizza is, every day, a little less incomprehensible, even when it costs a few bucks more than regular pizza.
Since 2008, we've seen gluten-free sales literally grow on a weekly to monthly basis.
And more restaurants are catching on. Going gluten-free is going mainstream. Domino's has a gluten-free pizza. Dunkin' Donuts is testing gluten-free baked goods. Joy DeBow is the director of nutrition at the National Restaurant Association.
What we've seen from a trend perspective is that, if you will, some Hollywood stars had decided to cut gluten or even wheat out of their diet, and they've lost weight, and now it's kind of become a buzz as a way to lose weight.
The gluten-free diet is hot. On the list of top restaurant trends, gluten-free items is number one with the fast food industry.
You know, people are now equating gluten-free to being nutritious. And I'm a registered dietitian, and I do not advocate for a gluten-free diet unless you have a reason to be on that diet.
But DuBose's advice doesn't seem to be stopping much of anyone. Harry Balzer is chief industry analyst at NPD Group, a consumer research firm.
In our latest data, which would take us up through the end of January, we'd have 30% of all adults saying they're trying to cut out or remove gluten from their diet.
That's one in three of us. Now, Balzer stresses that doesn't mean that all those people are actually eating gluten-free.
It's just that the interest in this has been growing.
All that flirting with gluten-free makes it attractive for restaurants. But it can be a bit of a rub for people like Amy Phillips, who has celiac disease and has to avoid gluten for medical reasons. She's eating a gluten-free pizza at Fresh Brothers.
So it's mostly a blessing that it's become a little more popular.
More trendy means more choices. But not everyone takes it quite as seriously as this pizza shop does. And Amy says when she tells waiters at some other restaurants that she has to eat gluten-free, she can sense skepticism.
Sometimes you can tell they think it's kind of like a no-carb diet or it's a little bit more than a trend. And I have to really stress I'm very allergic.
Domino's gluten-free pizza, for example, is for the trend followers, not Amy. The company makes clear that people with celiac disease not chow down. They're cashing in on the fad rather than any allergy need. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
There are more diets and trends out there than you can shake a stick at. Gluten-free, of course, is just one of them. Tell us which one you swear by and see what our listener poll says. It's at marketplace.org. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg had an op-ed in the Washington Post today. He announced a new group of Silicon Valley CEOs that's come together to back immigration reform. Unfortunately for him and them, the rollout was not without a mishap or two. A press release that included people who haven't actually signed on to the plan, like, say, you know, Bill Gates. An email that gave the wrong name for the group as well. Kind of basic stuff that I imagine you'll learn in policy lobbying 101. Not necessarily a high-tech CEO's basic skill set, huh? Sally Herships has the cautionary tale.
It's supposed to go ready, aim, fire. But in Silicon Valley, there can be a rush to get out new technology.
So what they're really doing is just the firing and the aiming, and they're forgetting about the ready part.
Luke Williams teaches innovation at NYU Stern School of Business. He says the slogan in the Valley is now ready, fire, aim.
Because, you know, it doesn't replace thinking, vision, and strategy. There's still an absolute need to do that, particularly if you're talking about doing something completely new.
Like a bunch of tech company CEOs starting a nonprofit. Andrea Matwishan teaches legal studies and business ethics at Wharton. She says Silicon Valley speed is also possible because legal protection is built into their products. Think about the web services you use. When you click yes on those agreements, it means you are responsible for any problems. So the tech companies can skip some of the protections that, say, a toy maker would have in place.
Such as the legal department saying we need to run three types of checks on this product because we're concerned about product liability concerns.
Because some tech companies have gotten so good at shielding themselves from liability, they've become sloppy with everyday operations.
Oh, boy. Okay, how do we safeguard leadership from their own mistakes? Is that it?
Louise Kehoe is director of reputation risk at Ogilvy Public Relations. She likes to tell her clients stories about other executives who've made mistakes.
Without identifying them, of course.
One corporate executive tweeted about having a great day on the last day of the quarter, which got him a slap on the wrist from the Securities and Exchange Commission. So, Silicon Valley CEOs, it could have been worse. Moral of the story, think before you tweet and aim before you fire. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up, it turns out, 2-all beef patty, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions on a sesame seed bun just ain't enough anymore.
Panera and Chipotle, Five Guys and Smashburger, they're stealing market share, and McDonald's really has to keep up with them.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials continued climbing today, added 62 points, 0.4%, 14,865 at the bell for the blue chips. The NASDAQ up 2 points, 0.1%. 3,300 on the nose. The S&P 500 gained 5 points, 0.3%. 1593, the number you're looking for. Yes, another record. Shipments of laptops and desktops dropped 14% last quarter, according to the research firm IDC. So I ask you this, what does the personal computer industry falling off a cliff sound like? Well, how about this? PC maker Hewlett-Packard down 6.5% today. Chip maker Intel off 2%. PC software maker Microsoft off more than 4% today. On Apple, which kind of started all this trouble with that danged iPhone and iPad thing, it makes PCs too, you know, lost 0.3%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for March. The United Nations marks the International Day of Human Spaceflight. And the Coachella Music Festival gets underway in Indio, California. 3 days in the desert. Hydrate, people. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Egyptian finance minister said today he is making, quote, progress in negotiations with the International Monetary Fund for a nearly $5 billion loan, which is good because the cash, when and if it arrives, is going to come in handy. Since the revolution 2 years ago, Egypt's mainstay tourism industry has been struggling at best, and so the amount of foreign currency in that economy has started to dry up, American dollars in particular. The government uses them to subsidize cheap fuel and bread, but regular Egyptians use them too. Julia Simon reports now from Cairo.
If you go into a bank or a currency exchange office in Cairo these days, you'll hear the same thing over and over again. Are there any dollars? This man asks. Nope, sorry, the guy behind the counter replies. Before the revolution, when there were still lots of tourists and investors in Egypt, the country's foreign reserves were $36 billion. Today, they are less than $13.5 billion. So you can't find dollars in the traditional places. But on the streets, it's a different story. Just blocks from the Cairo Stock Exchange, you see men looking back and forth nervously, repeating one word under their breath to passersby.
Sarafa, sarafa, sarafa.
Exchange, 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 they say. If you have dollars, they will buy and sell them for a premium. My friend Hossein Minet has $1,000 to exchange, and within minutes, Hossein is handed 7,200 Egyptian pounds, almost a 6% premium over the official exchange rate.
It's counting the money, a lot of 50s.
So you got a good deal there?
It's a good deal from under the table, yeah. You know? But in general, it's like for my country, it's not a good deal.
Hossein says the fact that he can get this deal so easily on the street is a symbol of just how bad things are in Egypt. The guy buying Hossein's dollars isn't some shady crook. Turns out he's an importer of toys from China. He needs dollars to get his shipments, and he started working the informal exchanges on the streets a month ago.
Take away.
In a wealthy neighborhood on the other side of town, the Genghis Khan Chinese restaurant now has a big sign on the wall announcing, "We are buying USD." Yushiku's family owns the restaurant, and she says they're paying a premium of about 3% over the official exchange rate.
And the reason is my mom is in China right now because she wants to expand her restaurant here in Cairo. So she's back in China buying equipment, so she kind of needs dollars.
Among the items her mom's hoping to buy is a new karaoke machine. Yu says at the same time her family needs to pay extra for dollars, they're making less profit on the restaurant because rising inflation has pushed food prices higher. Just then, the power went out in the restaurant.
No light.
It's part of rolling blackouts the government is staging because it doesn't have the foreign currency to buy enough imported fuel for power stations.
Good thing there are flashlights.
Despite all the problems, Yu says she and her family plan to stay in the country. But like many Egyptians, she wonders how much worse it will get before it gets better. In Cairo, I'm Julia Simon for Marketplace.
The unemployment rate for young people in this country, both men and women under the age of 20, is 25%. 5.2%. There are, of course, a whole lot of reasons for that. One of them is that young people don't really understand how to talk about their mistakes. Ashley Williams from Youth Radio explains.
I'm watching a 17-year-old fill out a job application for a Jamba Juice in Oakland, California.
Now I'm giving them my name, last name, first name, middle name.
It's a name we won't be using in this story. We'll call him Andrew.
Okay, now I'm giving them my email.
When Andrew was 14, a high school freshman, he took a gun to school. A shocking act for many considering the recent events in Newtown, Connecticut. But he says he did it just to be cool. 3 years later, Andrew is haunted by that decision, especially as he reads this part of the job application.
Have I ever been convicted of a crime except minor traffic violations? And I will check yes.
In the box below, where it asks for specifics, Andrew writes weapon charges. It's pretty easy to imagine what an employer would think reading those two words. Little did Andrew know, they're words he could have kept to himself.
I'm just going to say this because it's really important. Adjudications are not convictions.
Rachel Johnson Farias is a lawyer at the East Bay Community Law Center in Berkeley. Adjudication is basically a fancy word for when a court finds allegations to be true, which sounds a lot like a conviction. But in California and many other states, cases that begin and end in juvenile court are never called convictions.
On job applications, if the question is, have you been convicted of any crime? If you don't have any adult convictions, you can say no.
But the answer would be a yes in states like Iowa, where juvenile records are public. And even in California, it could be a yes if the application asks about arrests instead of convictions. Confused yet? Many places have gotten rid of checkboxes asking about criminal history with laws called Ban the Box.
Essentially what it does is it forbids employers asking about a person's criminal record.
That's Newark, New Jersey City Council member Ronald Rice. He wrote the city's Ban the Box law. It stops employers from asking about records until after they make a job offer. 43 cities and counties in 7 states have passed similar laws. Newark's is the most sweeping.
Continually penalizing people to not even give them the opportunity to apply for work is really anti-American, but it's also anti-business.
Anti-business, says Rice, because the whole economy suffers when people can't find jobs. But imagine learning at the very end of a hiring process that your top candidate committed rape or murder.
And you look at that and you go, oh my gosh, this just does not seem like it could be safe for my customers or in some cases for my employees.
That's George Allen from the Chamber of Commerce in Seattle. Allen's group fought early drafts of a citywide Ban the Box proposal because of costs and risks. Like, what if an employer rescinded a job offer after learning about an applicant's criminal record?
That applicant could turn around and sue the employer for unlimited emotional distress. And we just felt that that was just too heavy a hammer.
Allen says a new draft strikes a better balance. If the law goes through, Seattle employers will have more control, and applicants with criminal records might have a better chance at starting over. 17-year-old Andrew says it's all about redemption.
That never was really me. You can't really hold a person's past against them because the person could be different.
That may be what's inspired lawmakers in 8 more states from California to New Jersey to consider statewide Ban the Box laws, trying to figure out how much a person's past should affect their future. In Oakland, California, I'm Ashley Williams for Marketplace.
Ashley's story was produced for us by Youth Radio. Just having a robust dollar menu isn't enough for McDonald's anymore, apparently. According to company documents reported in the Wall Street Journal today, complaints about unfriendly and slow service have been rising with the economic tide. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports.
Fast food isn't called friendly food for a reason.
Welcome to King Burger, where we can do it your way, but don't get crazy.
On Mad TV, this is what happens when you have a complicated order.
A number 5 with a boneless, skinless chicken that is slightly seasoned.
Next.
Customer service can be an issue in real life, too. Mark Adler just got himself a coffee from this Manhattan McDonald's.
Usually,
they're pretty good about taking the next guest and whatnot, but the people behind the register tend to get a little bit testy when there's one long line.
For Noel Corbello, it's the long line that's the issue, not the smiles.
It's not that great, but you don't really care. It's all about speed. New York speed, always, yeah.
But there are reportedly increasing complaints about speed and smiles, and there's pressure to do something. Improving customer service is sort of a low-hanging fruit. Sam Okus is editor of QSR. It's a fast food industry magazine.
Customer service, that's something that they can really get to right now. A menu item, it takes a long time to develop, a long time to test.
McDonald's also has to worry about its smiling competition. These are places Okus calls fast casuals.
Like Panera and Chipotle, Five Guys and Smashburger. They're stealing market share, and McDonald's really has to keep up with them. And part of that's going to be in customer service.
McDonald's declined to comment on its plans, but the chain's reportedly creating a new job. Employees will hand out stuff like cups and condiments so more time can be spent being polite to customers. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace. And have a great day.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, as we leave you, from the Marketplace desk of I Don't Know What Is Wrong With You People. I'm referring to a new survey from the Pew Center for the People and the Press out today, in which I was astounded, gobsmacked, amazed to learn that 34% of my fellow Americans, quote, like or love doing their taxes. Now, I am as ready as the next guy to pay what I owe, more if necessary, to be honest with you, but love or even like that experience? I, for one, would rather go to the dentist, and I like my dentist a whole lot. Seriously. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow up 62 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ up 2 points, 0.1%. The S&P 500 up 5 points, about 0.33%. John Buckley, Kim Bowie, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. Thanks today to the staff here at St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Kaya Rizdal. I'm back in L.A. tomorrow. We'll see you then. And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.